Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, Buzzkillers. Here we are on the Buzzkill Institute, the Buzzkill Bunker, and we're going to talk today about something that is very prominent in American culture right now. With what's happened in Charlottesville, what's happened across the country has brought up so many questions and so many debates and so much tension about monuments and statues to Confederate veterans, Confederate soldiers, and members of the Confederacy. And here with me in the Buzzkill Bunker to talk about this difficult aspect of American history is Professor Phil Nash from Penn State. How are you, Professor?
Doing great, thanks.
Thanks for coming back to talk to us about something that not only troubles people back then, but troubles people now. But as we also often say, this happens with a lot of historical things. It happens when we talked about the Lost Cause myth. It happens when we talk about the Civil War. So the whole question of monuments and statues is very fascinating.
Right. The past isn't even past, as Faulkner once said.
No, it happens every day, as I once said, I think, in a couple of
weeks
ago.
If I may quote myself.
Because I deserve it. This thing about Confederate monuments, Confederate statues, it's a sort of strange thing about the United States, isn't it?
I have not... Let's be honest. I've not done a complete investigation.
Yeah.
But I have to assume it's relatively rare to have a country dotted by hundreds of memorials to people who are, I'm going to use the T word, who are traitors.
Yeah.
And I know that some listeners may find that upsetting, but I'm going to justify my use of that term because in my view, when you take up arms against your country to create a new country, in my view, and in the view of a lot of other people, that makes you a traitor.
In fact, that's the definition.
You may be in favor of that secession for whatever reason, but that does make you a traitor. And so it's very odd. Once that attempted secession is crushed and the country is reunified, then we have, we talked about this before, part of the reconciliation process and part of the way one side sort of internalizes or gets over its loss is it makes all these monuments to the traitors, to the people who tried to secede.
Right, right. And you and I have both been to a lot of countries in this wonderful world. The only place I've seen anything remotely approaching the United States in terms of numbers of statues is the old Soviet Union.
Right. Yeah, we do have a lot of statues. And there, by the way, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. I think, what,
yes,
1,500
right.
is a number I keep seeing. Depends on how you count them. Some are big, some are small. Some are in cemeteries, some aren't. We'll talk about that. But we're talking about hundreds of memorials to Confederate leaders and Confederate soldiers in particular. Let's not forget, we're not going to talk a lot about this, but we also have 10 forts and or military installations
that
are
never
named
comes up.
After Confederates. Fort Bragg, Fort Polk, a lot of these places are named after Confederate generals.
Oh, right.
Which I would argue is also extremely odd because these are bases for the United States Army,
yes.
And yet they're named after heroes of the Confederate States
and a fort
against whom the United States Army fought.
Right. And it was a fort that was originally fired on to start the military aspect of the war.
Fort correct. Sumter. Fort Sumter. That's right. Now, a lot of these are major, Fort Hood, I believe, as well. These are major military installations to this day named after Confederates.
Again, we can't think of any other place that does that.
It's a little odd.
So how does this happen? We know, and it's certainly been in the popular press these days, 2017, mm-hmm. that they weren't erected in 1866, right after the Civil War was over. How did it sort of start?
No, you can go online.
When did it sort of start?
Yeah, you can go
say.
Online and see a sort of a graph of when they were created. There were a few, and I mean a handful, that were created right after the Civil War.
Oh, okay.
But if you look at the graph, there is a surge that starts in the mid-1890s and peaks around 1910 and then starts to decline into the 1920s. If you look at the graph, that is by far the majority of these monuments are created in that period.
Mm-hmm.
Then the number drops off to near zero around the time of World War II.
Okay.
And then after World War II, especially starting around 1955, you see another sort of surge in monument construction. Not nearly as big as the first one, by the way.
Right.
But it's significant and goes into the mid-1960s.
So it's mid-1950s to the mid-1960s?
That's right. More or less. More or less.
Right.
And there are always exceptions, of course, and some of these are big monuments and some of them are small ones. So this is you know, you can always peel away the different layers.
In both of those periods of time, there are other things going on in our culture.
And that's the important thing. This is not, the timing is not coincidental. Almost all the people who study this would say that this is not coincidental and that this is not about just sort of neutral commemoration of the Civil War.
And not just about Confederates dying, Confederate actual soldiers dying.
Right. And it's possible that in at least a few cases, this has to do with anniversaries, like mm-hmm. the 50th anniversary and then the 100th anniversary.
Right.
But still, if you look, for example, at the big surge at the beginning, it's on the uptick starting in the mid-1890s, well before the 50th anniversary.
Oh, right. Okay.
So and even if you're taking into account possible planning in advance, it's clearly not primarily about an anniversary. What it is, in the first instance, it is a celebration and it is a delineation of the establishment of white supremacy after the Civil War.
Historians talk about this as the beginning of Reconstruction ends in 1877. And then in the 1890s, there's the beginning of this lost cause myth.
Right.
And that coincides exactly with this first period of statue.
And with this broader period of establishment of basically a replacement for slavery. In other words, the construction of a complete system of race oppression in the South, where African Americans are kept underfoot in every possible way. And symbolically, the way you wrap that up is with the veneration of Confederate heroes.
Okay, and so these are statues in a way to Jim Crow as much as they are statues to every other person.
And by the way, this is something true of all monuments everywhere, is that they tell you little, if anything, about what they depict.
Yeah.
They tell you a lot about the people who put the statue up and why.
That's right.
And that's really important to keep in mind. Let's look at Robert E. Lee, for example, whose statues always seem to be in the news. And a lot of Confederate statues are, some of them quite large, tributes to him. He dies in 1870.
1870,
5 years
after the war's over.
He died at the age of 63. He did not live very long after the Civil War. If it's about him...
And about the major Confederate dying.
Right. If it's just a tribute to him, devoid of any other context, you would expect to see memorials right away. You don't. You don't see Major Lee memorials until starting around 1890. The big one, the big memorial to Lee at Monument Boulevard, whatever it's called, mm-hmm. in Richmond, Virginia, yeah, right. The massive statue, that's dedicated in 1890. That is not coincidental.
No,
I don't think any historian would argue that's coincidental. This is about the onset of Jim Crow segregation and systematic race oppression. And the way you sort of trumpet that and mark that is with veneration of Confederate heroes, including Robert E. Lee.
Because, of course, they're trying to hearken back to a time they believed that was better.
That's right.
Before the Civil War. And they're trying to rebuild that society.
And where white supremacy, there was an attempt to enshrine white supremacy forever in a separate country.
Right.
Through secession. Now, there are at least a couple of monuments which may not technically be Civil War monuments, which are nevertheless literally about white supremacy. Famously, because this statue was removed, is the Battle of Liberty Place monument in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. New Orleans removed four monuments. Three of them were to sort of Confederate heroes, including Lee. One of them was the Battle of Liberty Place monument, which has nothing to do with the Civil War, at least not directly. The Battle of Liberty Place was commemorated by white supremacists because it was in 1874 a violent attempt at the takeover of government in New Orleans. There was a pitched battle, gun battle, between sort of the biracial government and the police force led by James Longstreet, by the way.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to him later.
We'll get to him in a minute. And white supremacists who short-term failed, but after a Reconstruction, starting in 1891, after Reconstruction, once again, not coincidentally, in the 1890s, this was considered a great heroic moment for the establishment of white supremacy, so let's build a monument to it.
Oh, okay.
So that's, okay. I would argue that monument is in some ways even more offensive than the other ones, and because it's not even indirect, it's direct.
It says about says something about the sustaining of the white race.
Exactly right. And there are a few monuments that talk directly about that. Normally, they're more indirect.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue partly they're indirect because they can be indirect, right? It can all be through inference.
Oh yeah, you don't need the statue of Robert E. Lee to say this was about establishing white supremacy in the South, because everyone knows.
Everyone,
Robert E. Lee.
Everyone knows what it represents, right? Oh, and by the way, and I mean everyone.
Yeah.
Former slaves walking in the shadow of a Lee statue know what it means too.
Yeah.
And that it's not just about, you know, the Confederate Army or whatever. These statues are also about the lost cause. And in a nutshell, that means that the Southern cause during the Civil War was righteous and even pure. There is, I'll give you one example. There's a famous monument in Augusta, Georgia. It's just called the Augusta Confederate Monument. You can look it up. It's topped by a particular soldier. I forget his name. Not a general, a soldier. At the top of the statue is a soldier who never surrendered. He was in Lee's army, and rather than turn over his gun and surrender like the rest of the soldiers, he just went home.
Uh-huh.
So he could technically claim that he had never surrendered. So he was not picked at random.
Oh, but he... Well, okay. He retreated. He went home. Okay.
Right. He did go home, but he did not technically surrender because that was just too degrading, too humiliating. But on this monument, it says, and I quote, "No nation rose so white and fair, none fell so pure of crime."
So the words white and pure are both used.
And it's basically, it's a pretty bold claim.
Yeah.
Right? That our cause is not only the cause of the South and Civil War is not only righteous, but it's completely righteous. We are blameless. That's sort of a that's the lost cause in purified form, yeah. Literally. But
and they say no nation,
right?
I mean, you know, they're talking about the period of from secession until the end of the war. They are their own nation, and
that's
that is
right.
Separate from the United States, and that is therefore treason.
Exactly. And also, in other words, this is not only just Southern pride, this is Southern exceptionalism.
Oh, I see.
Right?
I see.
This is like, we have a unique status, not just in the U.S. context, but in the world context. At least that's how I read that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite a claim, is my point. There are all sorts of interesting examples, some of them extreme. One is Henry Wirz, W-I-R-Z. He actually, I was surprised to find this out, he has a monument to himself. Henry Wirz was the commandant of the Confederate prisoner of war camp at Andersonville, Georgia.
Oh, the worst one, by far the
worst.
By
far the worst. 13,000 Union soldiers lost their lives here. It's a pretty infamous place. They actually made for TV movie about this.
Oh.
He was captured and put on trial after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
A trial presided over by Union General Lew Wallace, by the way, who wrote Ben-Hur.
Oh. Oh, history is strange, buzzkillers.
Yeah, it really is. Anyway, so he is convicted of war crimes because of the way he ran this camp and executed.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a part, and I, by the way, there were very few executions after the Civil War. The Lincoln conspirators, assassinated, they were executed, but there weren't many executions. He was one of them. He has a monument to himself. Partly because people in the Lost Cause myth, former Confederates, viewed him as sort of a scapegoat or a martyr.
Ugh.
And by the way, if you believe your cause is 100% pure and that none of you did anything wrong, then you feel like at some level you have to retrieve every single person's reputation, including a convicted, executed war criminal.
Yeah.
So you don't have to look too far to find the sort of extreme versions of this, but there really aren't any limits to it. A fascinating case all its own is also Arlington National Cemetery. So Arlington National Cemetery is one of my personal favorite sort of case studies here, partly in its origins, not in terms of Confederate monuments, but it was sort of in a way a Union monument because Arlington National Cemetery was created from Robert E. Lee's private property, which was seized without compensation.
It's his estate.
Which I believe he got through marriage. His wife had all the money.
Oh, no kidding.
I'm pretty sure. In any case, this is fabulous territory that
we call that a buzzkill bonus, by the way, here at the Institute.
Bonus!
That's where I got my money, and that's where.
So this is, if people have been there, and they should go if they haven't been, it's an amazing place. But it overlooks Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and this was seized early on in the war by the U.S. government. Quartermaster General Montgomery Meigs decided immediately, partly as a symbolic gesture.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. No, this was all deliberate.
His
idea was we are going to basically, we'll show him. In other words, we're going to deliberately and symbolically literally lay the Union dead at his feet.
Yeah.
Basically, we're going to turn his property into a Union cemetery. And by the way, he knew that after the war that Lee or his heirs would sue to get the property back.
Yeah.
So he deliberately buried bodies really close to the house to make repossession really difficult or even undesirable.
Yeah, sure. He wouldn't want to look out on his back porch drinking a mint julep and
look at all the Union gravestones. Yeah. By the way, there were a few Confederates buried there from the very beginning, a lot of them unknowingly. Some of the first buried bodies were just bodies that had been found, and it wasn't clear in all cases who was who. And by the way, he turned out to be true. After the war, Lee's heirs do sue.
But not Lee himself.
not Lee himself. He was dead. He was dead by then. His heirs sue because this was taken without compensation, which is technically illegal.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising they won that case. But they didn't. By that point, there's no point in them getting the property, so they got cash instead.
Oh, okay.
So they were compensated, but they didn't get the land back, and they didn't move the body. So it became the national cemetery. So, and like I said, this is a symbolic act. This is basically say, look, we know exactly who Lee is and what his role in all this was, and so what better symbolic act than to put all the dead in his property?
Which is true. It is a good symbolic act for what they were doing.
It is, in fact, or to my mind, the interesting thing is what happens later when Confederates start to be buried there. At first, decoration of Confederate graves, and there were some from the very beginning, but decoration of the graves, in other words, you being allowed onto the grounds to lay flowers on a tombstone,
right?
That's what I mean by decoration, that was forbidden.
Oh, okay.
That was not, in other words, this was an unabashedly United States official cemetery, mm-hmm. and traitors, for lack of a better word, are not going to be allowed to honor their dead here.
Okay.
That changes in the 1890s.
Oh, yeah.
Particularly in 1898, where Union Civil War veteran William McKinley, by the way, announces that Confederate graves will be tended to as an act of reconciliation.
Okay.
He was literally walking through the cemetery and saw there's some unkept, sort of poorly kept Confederate graves, and he thought that it was a disgrace.
Oh, does that mean before this, Arlington wasn't kept up, so to speak, by the government?
Yes, or at least not uniformly.
Oh, right, okay.
And not surprisingly, you probably have a lot of Union veterans involved who don't see it as their priority or as their job keep up, the graves of rebels. But in the 1890s, we have this act of reconciliation going on in many, many different ways, high and low, as white white Northerners and white Southerners slowly overcome their bitterness and the tensions and the differences between them, largely at the expense of African Americans.
I was going to say reconciliation in its own right is okay, except for this one includes this awful thing.
Yes, and it includes the Confederates dominating the process of writing the history of the Civil War creating public memory of the war. By 1914, fast forward, we have a Confederate memorial in place at Arlington. Large funds raised by United Daughters of the Confederacy.
Right, a big Confederate or Southern organization started really to do this sort of thing.
Right, to do this sort of thing, to help shape the history and to honor Confederates. So now, let's keep in mind, this is an official United States Army cemetery, and we are now allowing, as an act of reconciliation or an act of caving, however you want to say it, funds raised by United Daughters of the Confederacy, and Confederates are now memorialized. If you look at, it's a big memorial. If you look at it, among the figures around the mount, not the base, but the mount, it's a complex, the different parts of a statue.
Yeah.
The mount has all these figures on it. One of them, a loyal slave following his master to war.
You're kidding.
Nope. One of them is a loyal mammy. And these are both tropes, by the way. Powerful tropes, part of the Lost Cause myth about the pre-Civil War South being this honorable place. And slaves are not at all degraded or abused. They're actually part of the family. And so, of course, the loyal slave either follows his master to war or wants to. The loyal mammy, in this case, is holding a soldier's child as the child hugs it. Right. So there are, in other words, slavery is not avoided on this statue.
Yeah.
It's actually embraced and shown to be a good thing. There's another part of the statue where there's this figure, it's a female figure that's known as the South, it's a symbolic figure, leans on a shield, and on the shield is the word Constitution,
right,
which refers to what the South is allegedly fighting for.
So then not only does McKinley and whoever else allows this statue to go up, not only do they sort of recognize the Southern dead, but they then allow the celebration of this new version of Civil War history,
and
Southern history.
And they basically tolerate the establishment of official lies, which are essentially what these are, right? You have now sort of let these into the tent.
Yeah, right.
Gotcha. Nothing forcing you to do that, but they go along with it. And it is a form of, in terms of public memory, it's a way of rewriting history in a bad way. And
right.
You notice I said in a bad way, because we rewrite history all the time, and that's a totally legitimate enterprise.
Right.
Not in this case, because it is whitewashing the causes of the Civil War at the expense of the North and the expense of African Americans, I would say.
Yeah, because after all, the post-Reconstruction period, the 1880s, 1890s, goes along with the Lost Cause myth and sort of does everything except everything bad to African Americans except exactly. re-enslave them.
Right. And where the South, having lost the Civil War, wins the peace, to put it in very, very simple terms.
Yeah.
There is further indications of the fact that these statues are not primarily about the Confederacy, but about white supremacy. Obviously, they're about the Confederacy, but that's secondary.
It's that primary. Technically, it could be just a soldier's monument. Could be.
Could be. But
they could have been, I mean.
But keep in mind, there are lots of things to keep in mind here. Like, for example, who gets a monument and who doesn't? And if you look at this, you'll see some very prominent Confederate heroes, some of the leading Confederate generals, don't get a monument.
Mm-hmm.
And if it were just about Confederates and their performance on the battlefield
during the war,
these people would definitely get monuments. Exhibit A would be someone named James Longstreet.
Well, no, he's an important Confederate general.
Really important Confederate general. Easily one of Lee's most effective lieutenants. He was a corps commander.
Right.
He moved around a little bit, but he was mainly in the East. Very effective commander. His mistake is, after the Civil War, becoming a Republican and embracing biracial politics. In other words, basically going along with creating a South that's worth something in terms of from our standpoint, right?
Right.
In terms of allowing black people citizenship and the right to vote. He becomes the head of the police in New Orleans, basically in the context of a Reconstruction government, uh-huh. fights against white supremacy. So,
in other words, he's a Civil War hero,
Civil War hero.
And then he's treated as a traitor to the South
because of his post-Civil War activities.
In the 1870s and 1880s, and then when the statues go up in the 1890s, they say, well, we're not going to give one to him.
Because he's not a loyal ex-Confederate. He's not a white supremacist. No. Only recently,
he gets Gettysburg, but it's small and it's way off.
It's small and it's only very recently. I haven't seen it, but apparently it's not a very nice or heroic or sort of flattering depiction of him. So it's almost very grudging.
It's not anywhere near the main part of the
battlefield. But there are some dozens, maybe even hundreds of lesser lights in the Confederate Army who get monuments, and he doesn't. And he's not alone. There's another general, and he was a very good one. In fact, I think Lee at one point maybe even discussed him as a possible commander of the Army Northern Virginia later on, was William Mahone.
Okay.
Who was famous for the Battle of the Crater outside Petersburg, among other things. Very, very good, fast-rising Confederate general. He also doesn't get a statue afterwards. Why? Because he's also involved in sort of biracial politics. He is not a big D Democrat. He doesn't fight for reestablishment of white supremacy in Virginia after the mm-hmm. Civil War. So he doesn't deserve to get recognized if you're pro-Confederate or former Confederate.
I can't think of any clearer indication or any stronger argument based on evidence to prove that these statues are not about the Civil War and not about the actual valor, that they are about this 1890s and establishment of Jim Crow hatred,
right.
than this fact, even this fact alone. Mahone is part of what's called the reductionist, right?
That's
one of
right.
his things, he wants to reduce or spread out the Southern debt, certainly spread out the Virginia debt to make it more post-war debt to make it more manageable. But he also, as a realist, sort of deals with Reconstruction right. as Reconstructionism. So in other words, these two, Mahone and Longstreet, at the very least, they're living up to what Lee said after the war, and put that flag away. We're not going to fight for
right. –
that's over. We're going to now deal with the new world that we're dealing with. And yet they get ignored because they were, at least on the surface right. or at least publicly, willing to allow black participation in politics.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look at Longstreet. Longstreet, from what I've read, was not a saint and didn't believe in racial equality.
No, neither did Mahone.
But he's a pragmatist.
Right.
It's like there's a new regime, there's a new boss in town, and if we want to create a quote-unquote new South, we have to recognize certain realities and work with them. And that includes, you know, allowing black people to be citizens who get the right to vote, and we need to work with that. That was sufficient to get you written out of history in terms of public memory. I mean, I would look at it this way. If this is purely about commemorating Confederate greats, every state and locality would in effect write a list. Who are the great heroes mm. and great contributors to the Confederate cause from our state or our county? Let's build a monument to them first.
Yeah.
Longstreet Mahone should have been way, way at the top of that list, mm-hmm. and yet they never got a monument. Why is that? Because this is not fundamentally about the Confederacy and the Confederate cause. It's about establishing white supremacy and embracing certain Confederates as symbols and ignoring others.
And if you do the things that Mahone and Longstreet did, you get shunned by the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Sons of Confederate Veterans and people like that who are building the statues.
And then on top of that, if you're Longstreet, this discrimination then gets read back into the history of the war itself. And here the case is all about Gettysburg. Because Gettysburg, historians will tell you, Gettysburg was a Confederate failure mainly because of Lee. Lee ordered Pickett's charge, and it was a disaster.
Yeah.
Turning point in the war. Right. People should go read about Pickett's charge. It's really, really important. Longstreet becomes the bad guy at Gettysburg.
Why?
He basically commanded Lee's right wing, and he was a little slow to attack on the second and third days. He also had it, by the way, he didn't agree with Pickett's charge.
Mm-hmm.
The model in his head was more the model of, for the Civil War buffs out there, more the model of Fredericksburg.
Right.
In other words, what you do is you slip around the Union left, put yourself between the Union Army and Washington, D.C., and force the Union Army to attack you.
Yeah, because they got to protect Washington.
Right. And so win a defensive battle.
Yeah.
Don't win an offensive battle where you're charging out in the open across 3/4 of a mile of open, undulating farmland and get your men slaughtered in massive
Pickett's
numbers.
Charge.
Pickett's charge. Right? And so once again, remember, in the sort of the post-Civil War myth-making of the Lost Cause, Lee becomes a saint, can do no
1890s,
wrong. 1890s, yeah. Sorry. Long post-Civil War. In that sort of mythology, he becomes blameless. He becomes the perfect commander.
Yeah.
If we lost tragically at Gettysburg, it's because of somebody else. Hey, we have a scapegoat right here. His name is James Longstreet.
Who's been friendly to the blacks ever since the end of the war?
Not coincidentally. You could have picked other villains. Richard Ewell on the other side of the Confederate line didn't do a very good job. He easily could have been a scapegoat. No, you pick Longstreet. It's not coincidental. It's because he hasn't played ball with the project of reestablishing white supremacy after the Civil War.
This is just not only so clear, it's just so awful.
There's one other issue to talk about, and not just who gets it. Who gets put on a statue, put on a pedestal, literally, but also where they're placed. Because I think this gets overlooked too. Usually these monuments are in prominent public places, not mm-hmm. surprisingly. Sometimes they're in a park.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're at a sort of a what it turns out to be a major traffic circle or at the end of a major boulevard. If you look at the graph, which is available online, it's put together by the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's basically a graph that shows not only when monuments were erected, but what type they were. A lot of them, maybe even most of them, are put on the grounds of local or state courthouses.
Oh, where the laws are enforced.
Where the laws are enforced. I would argue this is another indication that this is not just about commemoration of the Confederacy. This is messaging.
Mm-hmm.
This is basically saying, anyone, black or white, who walks into this courthouse walks past a Confederate monument. Mm. It's a way of saying that this courtroom is a courtroom by and for white people.
Right.
They call the shots about what goes on in here.
And these states' laws were fought for by whichever general they want to put up in front.
And this anyone who enters this courthouse is subject to the laws of white men.
Right, which was true in the 1890s and post-Reconstruction.
One of the pillars of sort of Jim Crow segregation and this system of race oppression put in place after the 1890s is the legal aspect.
Yeah.
For example, blacks not allowed to serve on juries.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you know? The conviction rate against blacks accused of crimes is extremely high because all white juries convict the black accused as a matter of course.
Right.
So really it is a Jim Crow legal system in addition to everything else. And the placement of a Confederate monument becomes the perfect symbol for that.
Well, we've explained not only where they are, why they are, and who gets included and who doesn't get included and why they get included and don't get included. But there have been so many claims about different aspects of why these statues are where they are. But that's such a big topic. We're going to have to take care of it after this sponsorship break. Back in a minute. Okay, we're back. And Professor, so many claims anyway about these statues in today's world in 2017. Is there about heritage, not hate? They're about, you know, whitewashing history. Removing them would take a big chunk out of studying history as if people couldn't read books. But clearly we've already talked a little bit about the break, how that isn't true. We want to spend the rest of the show talking about why these things are historical myths and are literally not true because there's no evidence for them.
Right. Yeah, so there are, as you mentioned, there are these claims made today. Sometimes maybe they're not literal bumper stickers, but in effect they are bumper stickers of the neo-Confederates. In other words, they say when we embrace or defend a Confederate statue, they will say, quote, heritage, not hate.
I've seen heritage, not hate as a bumper sticker, okay, literally.
Yeah, I've never actually seen it as a sticker, but it's certainly out there as sort of a nice little soundbite for the neo-Confederates.
Yeah.
In other words, if I embrace or defend a Robert E. Lee statue, I don't hate anybody. It doesn't make me a racist. It means I'm just celebrating and remembering Southern heritage. Okay, that's nice sounding on its surface, but like as in all these cases, we have to test these claims. We have to like maybe peel back the layers. So my question immediately would be, whose heritage?
Oh, right. Yeah. It's a fundamental question.
Whose heritage? You are writing out of the picture a lot of Southerners who wouldn't or shouldn't support that version of heritage. What about the thousands and thousands of Unionist white Southerners? Mm-hmm. Southerners who, for all I know, were perfectly proud Southerners but didn't believe in secession.
Right.
They're supposed to celebrate Robert E. Lee. What about anti-slavery white Southerners? And they tended to keep quiet before 1860 for obvious reasons, but we know they existed.
Yeah.
Not support for slavery was not 100%. What about that? What about their Southern heritage? Or most importantly of all, I would argue, what about the millions of African Americans who lived in the South and still live in the South today? Right? You're making a claim for quote unquote Southern heritage.
Yeah.
Black people who were born and raised in Mississippi are Southerners too. What are they supposed to think when they walk by a Confederate monument? That's not their heritage. Quite the contrary. It's a slap against their heritage.
Right.
So there's a real problem with this claim. Why, you know, the heritage of what? Right? Not just whose heritage, heritage of what? What is the heritage? Heritage of secession and slavery.
Yes.
Which would be the two most important results of a Confederate victory in 1865 or 1864 or 1863.
If it had happened, yeah.
If it had happened, you would have had two separate countries, one of which preserved millions of people in bondage. Mm-hmm. So to put it another way, why not choose more inclusive, non-white supremacy-related heroes, right? The South has a rich literary heritage,
yes.
Rich musical heritage, rich cultural heritage, separate from slavery and white supremacy. Why don't you embrace those aspects?
Right.
It's not like a vacuum. It might be difficult, but it's not impossible to embrace other heroes.
Or the way a lot of these Confederate memorials have an anonymous Confederate soldier, like one, you know, an infantryman or whatever. Why not have an anonymous Southern agricultural worker?
Sure.
White one and a black one. Or whatever.
Right.
Or a
Southern shopkeeper. There are all sorts of directions you could do without embracing the Confederacy and by implication, white supremacy. Or put another way, why is there, and obviously this is easy for me to ask as a Yankee, why is your regional identity more important than your national identity?
Yeah, that's right.
Because you can buy, I've seen them, you can get a Confederate battle flag that has a seal imposed on the center of it. And it has, I think it has some Confederate fighter with waving a flag. And it says, the South shall rise again. What does that even mean, rise again? Are you going to reinstitute slavery? How are you oppressed now? I could argue in a lot of ways you dominate our national politics.
Yeah. Are you going to fire again on American forts?
Rise again.
You're going to become a traitor to the country again?
Millions and millions of white non-Southerners somehow managed to go through their lives head held high without embracing a regional identity first above the national identity.
Yeah, yeah.
So why couldn't you switch the one for the other?
Well, I can't imagine New Englanders, for instance, who do have a regional identity, or certainly a regional accent.
Sure.
What? You know, that doesn't exist in New England, doesn't exist in the West, doesn't exist in the Midwest. Right. And people tell me, you know, I'm a Midwesterner. Well, that means you follow Chicago Cubs, but so what?
Right. And that somehow coexists with the sense of national identity.
Exactly.
It doesn't blot out the national identity.
And it's only in the South this happens.
Correct. And then there's another claim, which is sort of, it's important to remember history.
Yeah, well.
Well, it's interesting.
It was important to remember Longstreet and Mahone, but they didn't get remembered.
But they didn't get somehow got left out. This is very interesting. There have been done some recent surveys. One, two states in particular, Georgia and South Carolina. But they did a survey in Georgia, and they found a – now, it's a correlation. It's not causation, and people should always be careful about this when they look at polling data.
Whoa. We got to explain that for a minute. There are a lot of non-statisticians who are buzzkillers.
Correlation. In other words, two facts about a group of people that exist together, but that doesn't mean one leads to the other.
Okay, yeah.
Right. All you can establish is they coexist. And that's unfortunate. In a lot of media coverage of polling data and studies of all types often conflate the two. It's a big problem. In any case, they found in studying people in Georgia recently a negative correlation between support of the Confederate flag and knowledge of Civil War history.
What?
Yes. In other words, you would think that when people say you can't tear down a monument or you can't take down the Confederate flag because it's important to remember history, those people who say that, according to this study, know the least about Civil War history. And if you're wondering how they did this, is they asked respondents a series of basic factual questions about the Civil War. They asked four questions. And they were like, for example, like, who is William Tecumseh Sherman?
Yeah.
And if you know anything about the Civil War, you know who he is.
Sure.
And if you don't know who he is, you probably don't know much about the Civil War.
And if you're a Southern, you certainly have an opinion about it.
Certainly if you're a Georgian.
Yeah.
In any case, those who got 0 out of 4 questions right were twice as likely to support the Confederate flag as those who got 4 out of 4 right.
In other words, the correlation is the more you know about the Civil War,
the less likely you are to embrace flying the Confederate flag.
Okay.
They also found a correlation between racial prejudice and support of the Confederate flag. 44% support the flag and don't object to interracial dating. 64% support the flag and do object to interracial dating, which is an interesting – they just asked that one question, but it's an interesting question that tries to get at racial prejudice.
Right.
Right? Because let's think about it. If you're a racist, that's the kind of thing that you might show your colors, right?
Like blood boil. Yeah.
Right. I object to interracial dating. So big difference between those two groups. In Georgia and South Carolina, people who agreed with the statement, blacks face a lot of discrimination. In Georgia, 44% support the flag. In South Carolina, 19% support the flag, and I mean the Confederate flag. The statement, blacks face no discrimination at all. In Georgia, 74% support the Confederate flag, and in South Carolina, 57% support the flag. So once again, not necessarily causation, but there's a correlation between those who support the Confederate flag and those who believe or don't believe that blacks face discrimination.
And we are talking about the flag here, but the flag is like the statues. The flag is like the monuments. It's a major, major symbol.
It's a major symbol and the subject of some of the same sorts of battles.
It is the Confederate battle flag. It's not the battle flag of... It's not the
national flag.
National flag of the Confederacy.
Correct.
They've got, we'll say the wrong flag.
Right.
But is it a different flag?
Yes, it is. It's interesting. And another claim is you're whitewashing history. In other words, by tearing down a monument or flag, I guess you could also throw in here, you are whitewashing history. Here's a quote from a Mississippi state representative recently by the name of Carl Oliver. The destruction of these monuments erected in the loving memory of our family and fellow Southern Americans is both heinous and horrific, end quote. Those politicians who want to remove these symbols, quote, in a Nazi-ish fashion, burn books or destroy historical monuments of our history in all caps, they should be, all caps, lynched. He retracted the form lynched.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, right. Well.
So he apologized for that one extreme term at the very end there. But it is, to me, fascinating how he's basically appropriating the language of anti-Nazis in support of white supremacy.
In other words, if
you want to tear down a monument to Robert E. Lee, you are trying to erase history. As if the people who defend the retention of statues are trying to contextualize or learn the downsides of Confederate history.
Yeah.
On the contrary, they're trying to whitewash it.
Or learn or memorize the whitewashed version.
Right. To put it another way, if this is all about history, why not more statues honoring slaves?
Yeah.
Or black soldiers? Or, let's leave aside African Americans, why not monuments to Unionist white Southerners?
Yeah.
If you've reconciled, if you consider yourself a proud American, why not a monument to a white Unionist?
Yeah, of which there were a lot, as we've talked about before.
Or, and this gets back to that other question about, you know, finding a national identity. Leave aside the Civil War. Why don't you just build a monument to a white Southerner who gave his life in service of the United States during World War II?
Of which there are thousands and thousands.
Thousands and thousands.
Right.
Right. Why not? Why not shift the focus of your commemoration to a worthy national symbol rather than this narrow white supremacist regional symbol? Yeah. There's nothing preventing you from doing that.
No.
I mean, no. apart from the financial cost.
Yeah, replacing a Confederate statue with a World right. War II vet. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or a Korean War vet or a Vietnam War vet or a post-World War II Southern politician who worked for reconciliation. I mean, yeah. there are all sorts of things you can yeah. do, right? Why this fixation on Confederate heroes?
Well, it's they're saying also that this lost cause version of Southern history is the only, not only version yes. of Southern history, but it's the only period of yes. Southern history, which is just right. frankly weird.
Now, partly that is a problem endemic in monument building in its nature.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. And you're freezing a moment in time.
Right. And you were particularly, I mean, it's hard to show, I guess you could, but it's hard to show, or harder to show multiple points of view of history.
Right.
Which legitimately coexist in many, many cases, not this one. It's hard to depict that in a statue, but it's not impossible. You can find symbols that are at least have broader appeal, certainly. But my premise here is that monuments are not about teaching or learning history. Even, right, there's only so much. Monuments are the historical version of Twitter. There's only so much information you can convey on a plaque.
Right,
people are not
right.
going to pull up a lawn chair and sit down and read 5,000 words chiseled in tiny, tiny print on the side of a monument. You're going to have to boil it down. Even the best monuments boil history down to a soundbite.
Statue of Liberty.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of them, even the best ones, even if they try, give it the old college try to be even-handed or, you know, create context or provide historical nuance, mm-hmm. it's very difficult to do. You're probably going to have oversimplification or distortions.
Yeah, and that's why people say, you're destroying our history, but we're saying, go read more history.
Go read more history.
Beyond the statue version of history.
If you rely on monuments for your history, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Just like if you rely on movies for your history, you're in trouble.
Oh, you're in real trouble.
So, yeah. I mean, at some level, people who like historians go into a movie, oh, it's so historical. It's a movie, right?
Right, right.
You're going to have some distortions and oversimplifications.
Well, some movies are worse than others.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, oh, no, no, yeah. no, no. Don't get me wrong. Absolutely right. But so in other words, monuments are not about history. They're about who we honor. They're also expressions of power, right? Who's in power at a particular time, who has the power to raise money and to get their version put out there. That's always going to be, that's unavoidable.
Yeah.
But still, bottom line is statues are about who we honor.
Right.
And then the
right.
question is, do you honor Robert E. Lee?
Yeah.
I would argue that we do not and should not. You know, and we'll put it another way. If you take down a statue of Robert E. Lee, can you still learn about him?
Of course.
Of course. Yeah. The idea that you're erasing history is mind-boggling to me. There will still be way too many books occupying space at the bookstore on the bookshelf in the history section yeah. on the Civil War.
Yeah.
There's plenty you can learn about him. Historians are still writing great stuff about him. There's still stuff to write about him legitimately. History is still being written. Even histories of the Confederacy and about Robert E. Lee that are fair are being written by the quote-unquote liberal professors.
Yeah. And this just reminds me so much of that correlation study you looked at before, where they're talking about the people who know the least about the Civil War are the ones who are also the strongest adherents to this idea that the flags and the statues must remain and that they are taking them down as an abuse of history.
That's right.
And they know the least history.
Yep. Or to put it another way, is the Civil War still being taught in school? Of course it is.
Yeah.
You might even argue, in some cases, I'll bet it's being overtaught. In other words, too much attention devoted to it at the expense of other subjects, like in a U.S. history survey course, for example.
Right. Okay.
You could argue I'm guilty of that when I teach it.
Well, there might be an interesting study out there for you buzzkillers who are about to enter graduate school. Compare how many questions on the, what's the kids when they go into college, the ACT and the
SAT.
On the SAT, look at the number of questions about different subjects. If there are more questions about the Civil War than about World War II, there's something wrong. If there are more right. questions, in other words, does the Civil War dominate mm-hmm. American historical discourse? And maybe it does.
Right.
So there you go. There's a topic for you young budding PhD buzzkillers.
All of you headed to grad school.
Well, so in other words, what should we do? There's this question, remove or not remove, you know, what do we do? Does removing it cause yet another scar?
So here's my premise, and obviously not everyone's going to agree with me here. My premise is leaving these up as is. It's a disgrace. Mm-hmm. Why are we honoring traitors? What is an African-American or a non-native Southerner or a pro-Union Southerner who, by the way, going forward, in many cases, whose tax dollars help pay for the upkeep of these things? Oh, what are they supposed to think and feel by walking one of these? So it seems to me you can't just leave them up. There is obviously a legitimate debate to be had over the alternatives. There are lots and lots of alternatives. Some of them are fascinating. By the way, I'm not recommending this, but I thought it was an interesting anecdote. In Martinique, an island in the Mediterranean, in the Caribbean, which is still part of France, by the way.
Yeah.
There was a statue of Josephine Bonaparte, Napoleon's
right.
wife,
right,
which was beheaded by Vandals.
Oh, that's
somebody cut the head off, which I would not support. But the people of Martinique decided to keep the statue up as is.
Oh.
Which is really interesting, right? In other words, they had a decision to make at that point. What do we do? Do we fix it? Do we tear it down? They decided to leave it up headless. Which, once again, I'm not recommending, but I thought it was an interesting sort of it, like, it raises the issue, and then they make a decision to keep it as it is.
Well, and also
as a new statement compared to the old statement.
Yeah, because you're saying, well, if it's all about history, then the millisecond after the beheading, then the beheaded statue becomes history. So if you take it down, then you are also messing with history.
So
it goes on and on and on.
Like I said, I wouldn't recommend that, but you can change symbols in a way. Now, there are some people who say that, for example, you should contextualize them by adding a new plaque or a new marker that puts the statue in historical context. To my mind, that would be an important step forward. But the problem with it is, even if you add an additional plaque or marker or whatever and leave the rest of the thing intact and leave it in place, it still has pride of place.
It's still a statue.
It's still a statue in a prominent place. It's still in a place of honor. So it's better than nothing, but I personally wouldn't support that.
And when we're arguing these things, Buzzkillers, let's remember, of course, a lot of, even subconsciously, a lot of Professor Nasser's own opinions and my own opinions will creep into these things, but these are mainly the things that have been argued carefully, very carefully, by historians and sociologists and political science for a long time. They've studied this for a long time.
And are continuing to study it.
Right.
And like I said, I will say it again, this is a legitimate debate and should be held probably on the local level.
Sure.
Localities and counties and states, they should have public discussions, right? Public comment, and they should decide, what do we do with these monuments? And it'll be different solutions in different cases. Mm-hmm. Some people say they should be removed to museums, which I think would be a nice solution. The problem with that is there's a great expense. It takes up a lot of space in a museum.
Yeah.
Some of them, frankly, would not fit in a museum because they're enormous.
Yeah.
Although there are some physical problems in some cases.
There could be a lot more contextualization going on in a museum than
outside. That's true. Moving them to private property is an option.
Yeah.
And then if you want to go and sort of, you know, pay homage to someone like Robert E. Lee, you could do that. Maybe buy a ticket to access somebody's property.
And that's not... United States, we can't prevent somebody from having that
correct,
thing.
Correct, nor should we. If you want to build a monument to pretty much anybody you like on your private property, knock yourself out. It's a free country, right? Build a monument. Professor Buzzkill wants to build a monument to Professor Buzzkill?
No, the Buzzkillers build a monument to me, and I'll send my dimensions to anyone who emails me.
Because we want it to be lifelike.
Yeah, oh yeah.
In any case, what else could you do? You could cluster them all, and I know in the former Soviet Union they did this.
Yeah, right.
In other words, create one park and to put them all together. And then the fact that they've been moved and clustered itself becomes a kind of a message.
Right, right.
That these people existed, and once they were memorialized, but we don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And that kind of also, by the way, helps satisfy the people who, incorrectly in my view, are arguing that you're erasing history. You're not erasing. They're still out there. You can still go look at it. Mm-hmm. It's just not in pride of place. It's not a place of honor anymore. You could do that. This is never going to happen, but I was thinking about this probably too long, and I love the idea of next to a statue of Lee, build a much bigger statue of like a freed slave overlooking it.
Oh, right, right.
Which, like I said, is never going to happen, but that's a way of maybe subtraction by addition, basically. In other words, you show what we honor and what we value without removing the old statue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to me, that would be a way of providing context. But, you know, these sorts of monuments to slaves and to black soldiers are extremely rare.
Yeah, very, very rare. They are
very, very rare. And so
there are some monuments to free black slaves, including some of the breaking chains iconography, particularly in the British slave trade. There are some of these statues, but they're pretty rare.
They're extremely
rare.
But
it also goes to this question of why is America obsessed with building statues. Most other countries don't build as many as we do.
Right. And that's partly because of our fraught history with race oppression, basically. Mm. But I would argue there's a certain justice here, because the original and subsequent purpose of these monuments was white supremacy. And yet the efforts to take them down recently have been spurred by white supremacy. There was a big, for example, it's not a monument, it's a flag, but the flying of the Confederate flag on the grounds of the South Carolina state capitol, which was very controversial for years and years and years.
Yeah.
The impetus finally to take down that flag was the mass murder committed by the white supremacist Dylann Roof in 2015.
That's right. That's right.
This infamous incident where he gunned down, incredibly cold-blooded act, by the way, guns down 9 African Americans in church. Mm-hmm. He was a white supremacist, avowed white supremacist. That was the impetus to tear down the symbol of white supremacy. And it also happened, it's happened recently too, with the incidents mm-hmm. in Charlottesville, Virginia, where acts of white supremacy trigger their own pushback.
Yeah.
And efforts to, there was a rash of taking down Confederate monuments after the Charlottesville murder by a white supremacist, allegedly.
And particularly with the Dylann Roof case, if you're taking down the Confederate flag in reaction because of what's happened with Dylann Roof, the state was implying that this was a symbol of these awful tragedy, of these awful white supremacy and awful slavery and all things like that, and therefore it should come down. That's a recognition of what it was there for.
Right. And my reaction to that big picture would be better late than never. It's taken way too long for a lot of us to come around to recognize what these monuments are fundamentally about. Mm-hmm. And even though it took too long, it's never too late to take down a Confederate monument.
Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. Puts everything more in context, we think, than before. Talk to you next week.